With the astute timing and political acumen that characterises this podcast, today's episode of Not Enough Champagne is all about sticking up for politicians. We're going to talk about three things. We're going to talk about the barriers to ordinary people entering politics, we're going to talk about the demonisation of politicians and MPs, and we're going to see how we can maybe improve the makeup of local councillors. We're going to do all of that after this jaunty theme tune. One of the reasons for that is that I'm bald, and as we've discussed in the previous podcast, if you are bald, there is no way that you can make it in politics.
I don't know, you could get a Trump-styled comb over.
But I am, however, joined by two politicians of varying degrees of... I'm not going to finish that sentence. I'm joined by my partner in propaganda, Steve Haynes.
Hello, I would say ex-politician at the moment.
And, but again...
an actual politician.
Again, who's recovered, I think, hopefully somewhat from our American Elections podcast. I'm joined by Councillor Bridget Jones. Hello, Bridget.
Hello.
Steve, so you call yourself an ex-politician.
I used to be a member of the Liberal Democrats. I've stood for the council. I've run for Parliament for the Liberal Democrats. I've done everything that politicians do other than win an election, which, you know, that tends to be the barrier you need to cross over to be an actual professional politician, I find.
Those bloody voters.
Yeah.
And Bridget, you're an actual, one of those professional politicians I have now.
Yeah, I'm one of those evil pros, yeah. So I'm a councillor for Birmingham City Council. I've got the cabinet portfolio for children, families and schools, which keeps me busy. And I've stood four times, elected on two of them.
And what have your experiences been on the campaign trail? So do you, even at local council level, do you kind of get that anti-politician rhetoric?
Oh yes.
Yeah, you definitely do. This is actually one of my favourite memories from just doing some campaigning. I was campaigning for one of the other then Lib Dem councillors who went on to lose the election.
Narrow it down.
Ouch. But Dave Radcliffe.
Oh, I like him.
Yeah. Obscure Birmingham reference.
we were knocking up on people for supporters on election day, and I knocked on this one bloke's house, and he comes to the door, and I'm like, "Hi, my name's Steve. I'm here from the Liberal Democrats.
I'm here to help you.
Yeah, we're just here. There's an election today. We're wondering if you're going to vote, and if you are, who you're going to vote for." I then spend the next 15 to 20 minutes stuck on this guy's doorstep as he lambasts me, one for being a Liberal Democrat, two for believing in human rights, and three for thinking that thinking refugees actually need help. Somewhat foolishly, potentially, I stood to my ground and argued with him for about 15 or so minutes, which is something you're not normally supposed to do.
That's the kind of thing us on the Labour Party like to hear. The opposite team tied up on the doorstep.
Yeah, I know.
You sure it wasn't a Labour voter in disguise?
No, he was definitely UKIP. I'm having this argument with him. And after a while, we end up kind of coming to the end of it. And he turns around to me and says, "You know what? I don't like the Liberal Democrats. You know, you believe in human rights and all of these things, and I don't agree with you. I'm voting UKIP, but I don't actually want them to win because they couldn't organise a piss-up in a brewery," to which my response is, my head explodes internally. And then, just to put the icing on the cake, he turns around and basically says, your guy Dave, Dave Radcliffe." I'm like, "Yeah, he's a really good local councillor. We always see him around here. So, you think we're a good... for the area, you like our local councillor, you're really actually quite pleased that someone's knocked on your door and actually stood the ground and actually had debated with you, because it means someone's actually listened to you, and you're still not going to vote for us." And he's like, "Yeah, no, you're just too establishment." It's like, "Okay, good afternoon, sir. I'm just going to go now and just bang my head against the wall repeatedly."
When I first started campaigning, the Iraq war was still looming over the Labour Party.
And when thank heavens that issue's gone away.
Yeah. And I'd go to a doorstep as a council candidate and people would say to me, "I'm not voting Labour because of Iraq." And I started saying to them, "Look, I'll make you a promise right here, right now, on the doorstep, me to you. If you elect me to Birmingham City Council, I won't invade any foreign countries.
Robin Cook, also on the doorstep in the 2005 election, apparently got people saying, I can't vote for Labour because of the Iraq War. And it's like, it's Robin Cook. The man could not have done any more to show he was against the Iraq War.
And people don't differentiate between individual candidates a lot of the time, or levels of government a lot of the time.
Yeah, or indeed the notion if you're just somebody who's given it a go and someone who's actually a slick professional. Anybody who comes knocking on the door and says, hello, I would like your vote, suddenly there is a shift in how you can get dealt with. 90% of the time, it's absolutely fine. Everybody's kind of really polite. Your supporters will be yes.
Yeah.
So your opponents will be, I'm sorry, I really don't like that party or whatever. But occasionally, you just get some absolute kind of abuse hurled at you just for actually daring to participate in the democratic process.
The worst ones are the letters. Really vicious people. Don't do it to your face. They write you a letter in good hard ink on paper and they send it to you.
My favourites are always when we do surveys through the letterboxes and basically tell people, say, if you leave them hanging out your letterbox, the next half hour or so we'll grab them, knock and drops. And it's just like some of the comments you get on them as part of the surveys are just absolutely wonderful. I remember one just kind of saying how they quite agreed actually with what the Lib Dems were doing in government with the coalition, and they weren't too fussed about tuition fees and all of that sort of stuff, but they could not stand the fact that it had taken 6 weeks to fill in the pothole on their road, and therefore their vote would be going to the Conservatives. So you're fine with all the shit that actually matters, but because we didn't do this one thing really, really quickly, that's what's costing us your vote.
It is fascinating knocking on doors and talking to people, because they will hold you to account for everything from the Iraq War all the way down to that tree outside their house, that pothole. And when you knock on the door, you don't know what kind of person you're going to get on the other side.
You could end up with a complete revolutionary socialist who's angry that you're not helping overthrow the neoliberal capitalist system.
Why are you door knocking Jeremy Corbyn?
Or you end up with this person who's really, really into the parking regulations. During the 2015 election, I did a hustings with all of the other candidates. And the first question that came up was from this one of the local voters. What's your opinion and how will you resolve the parking issues outside of Norfield train station? And they come to me first on the thing. I'm sat there kind of going, I don't have a fucking clue. Are there problems with parking at Northfield train station?
See,
I don't normally use it.
It's that range that you're expected to know about as a candidate is extraordinary.
Yeah, and the thing is,
keeping up with people's expectations is so difficult.
I think that's why Trump did so well, because he would have said, I've got all the best solutions, I've got all the best car parking, I've got all the best car parks.
Car parks, very important. Love the car parks. We're going to build a wall around the car park.
the worst thing that about that...
We're going to make Celia pay.
The worst thing about that question, though, was just that the Labour MP and my opponent, Richard Burden, was also the Shadow Minister for Transport for Labour. So I'm sat there kind of running through, kind of going, well, it's very important to listen to local people's opinions. And then he just reels off an entire kind of policy manifesto commitment on parking and things like that. And I'm like, okay, fair enough.
It can be very difficult to harness that kind of anti-politics vote, can't it? I remember giving leaflets out for the AV campaign in Stoke. And
how did that go, Corey?
So the AV campaign slogan, as I'm sure you all remember, listener, is was make your MP work harder.
And we had a slogan?
The campaigners didn't know the slogan is maybe and one of the many reasons why AV did not quite pass. But so you're giving out in a city centre these leaflets say, make your MP work harder. Because obviously we're trying to capitalise on that anti-politics vote that was going about. And someone replies that the MP should work harder building their own gallows.
Wow.
And it's kind of when you realise that you can't...
Wow.
How do you harness that anti-politics vote in a positive way? Because as you've kind of alluded to, it's really difficult to get any of the established parties, even, you know, it ends up just being a populist outsider doing that. Oh, it needs to be someone like UKIP or it needs to be someone like Trump, who is just not part of that establishment.
It was something I found quite hard to come to terms with when I first got elected, and it was the fact that so many people I'd never met and I'd never done anything to in my life suddenly hated me. And they hated me because suddenly I was a politician and I was getting paid to do politics. So as soon as I got elected, the letters started arriving. Not large numbers, but enough to get under your skin. And people you'd never heard of before, you'd never met, suddenly would write to you because you're an evil bastard lying politician and you definitely weren't going to do anything about this list of things that they were interested in because you're a liar and a bastard and you should quit.
I never had any personally, just because I never won an election, but you still get sent some random comments here and there and the odd email which comes through to you, and you look at the list of things that they're complaining about, and as you say, they're all kinds of random, from local to international, and you look at them and you kind of go, I am in agreement with you on like 90% of these. I would love to do all of these things. However, I'm running for city council. I can do the potholes, maybe.
The reactions of people are so interesting. So I actually started, a few months after I got elected, I started lying about what my job was to new people. I kept the charade up with my driving instructor for an entire year before he saw me on the bloody news at 6 that evening and then blew my cover. But I just lied to him about my job, because I had a previous driving instructor who I'd had to let go because the moment he found out I was a counsellor, every driving lesson it was, so what do you think about Tony Blair? Why do you defend Gordon Brown? I mean, I wasn't defending Gordon Brown. I was attempting to turn left. This is really hard for me. It's my second lesson.
It's also a very bad metaphor.
At least I wasn't trying to turn right. Or stuck on a roundabout. So I actually dumped my driving instructor. It wasn't a relationship. It wasn't a breakup. I got a new driving instructor, and I just lied to him. I said I work for the council, and just left it at that. And I mean, obviously, as the weeks went by, he started to ask, "What do you do for the council?" Because I was scheduling lessons at weird times, and you know, turning up sometimes in a suit and sometimes in jeans, where I've been on a litter pick with someone. And he must have queried what exactly my job was on quite a few occasions. But it just made my life easier, and I do that a lot. I lie to people about what my job is. I just say I work for the council, because otherwise, you just see their faces change. When you say that you're a counsellor, that's the worst case scenario. The best case scenario is they go, what kind of counselling? Drugs and alcohol counselling, family breakup counselling.
And the Labour Party, yes, a bit, yes, of everything, I suppose. But why is that? Is that because, do they want to then ask you lots of questions about potholes? Is it because they assume that you're a lying scumbag politician? Like, why is that?
Usually the latter, sometimes the former. Some of it, I think, is the British thing. So, you know, the British don't like to have controversial conversations. You know, we like to keep things safe. We don't like to talk about politics too much. They always say, don't put, you know, religion and politics in your CV, which is a problem for me because my CV is politics. A bit screwed there. So I think some of it is, you know, British politeness of not wanting to get into an argument with somebody you might disagree with. Just silly in itself, so you don't have to argue with a politician all the time.
You just go, that's nice.
Yeah.
Would you like some tea?
Yeah, weirdly, when we're, you know, off duty, we don't want to have an in-depth discussion about the 10p tax rate and Gordon Brown's view on that.
I don't think this demonisation of politicians is a new thing. Ipsos Mori have been asking how trustworthy are various professions since 1983, and estate agents and politicians have been at the bottom of that scale since 1983 when they started asking the question. So only 16% of Brits trusted politicians to tell the truth in 2005. It was only 18% in 1983. Where, you know, people like doctors, people like teachers, people like police officers have kind of stayed quite high in the question since then. I mean, I think people have always been quite cynical about politicians. Is it just, maybe we've talked a bit about it on the previous podcast, but is it social media? Is it the internet? Does that make things slightly worse? Does it make things more polarised?
I mean, I think when it comes to social media and polarisation, yeah, it certainly does, because you can just, there's just so many opportunities for someone to put something out there, which is, maybe it's legitimate, maybe it's half legitimate, maybe it's just complete bullshit. It's an article will go up on a website like the Canary, say, or Breitbart,
you know, it'll go around the world or go around the country really, really quickly in the right circles, and before somebody's had a chance to go, no, that's wrong. Which means more and more people see lots of things about how this politician cheated on its on their expenses when actually they didn't.
But so is it the expenses scandal that was the big watershed? I don't really feel like the reputation of politicians as a kind of political class has kind of recovered from that, really. Do you get a lot of questions about expenses? Yeah.
Should we claim anything as a hot topic, actually, for councillors? There's a lot of people who believe we shouldn't get paid at all.
But those people are wrong.
you'd be stunned, the range of people who think we shouldn't be paid at all to be councillors.
It doesn't surprise me, but it's like people who go, oh, MPs shouldn't get expensive or councillors shouldn't be paid. It's like, well, you do realise the only way they can do their jobs and actually help you and do the things that they're supposed to do is by having that money. Because if you're a councillor and you've got to travel around a ward, okay, in Birmingham, it's relatively easy to travel around the ward you represent. Because
yeah, quite compact.
Yeah, you can probably walk from one end to the other in about 20 minutes or so. In other parts of the West Midlands that are more rural, you probably have to drive 10, 15 minutes to get to the other side because they're very, very big. And if you've got somebody who's not rich, the fuel costs for that, it's going to add up over a year. So that's why you have expenses, so people can do those things, so that they can actually represent and look after their constituents.
And to employ staff to actually look
do
through
things.
Because
yeah.
What people expect their MPs to do has completely changed over the past 40, 50 years. So it used to be MPs didn't have to visit their constituency, do public meetings and what have you, and do constituency surgeries.
Yeah, and ditto for councillors as well. So if you look at what I did on Tuesday as an example, I spent all day locked in a budget meeting trying to work out how to cut 103 million quid out of the city council's budget this year. And then in the evening, I went to a local meeting about flooding in my local ward, which couldn't have been further removed. On Thursday, I kicked off the day with a walkabout with my locals, looking at did we have double yellow lines in the right places? And, you know, did we have the right parking restrictions locally? Unfortunately, we did this on a day after very heavy leaf fall, so we couldn't see any of the damn double yellow lines. Top tip, don't do that in autumn next time. I went from that into a meeting where we were looking at the school's budget for the city, which totals 1.2 billion. And a pupil that had been stabbed. Yeah, it's quite a range of things that we do. It's all equally important to voters and to, you know, people on the streets, but it's such a range.
And it feels really weird that Britain is very much a cult of the amateur, and it feels very strange that it's this kind of expectation that you would do it for free. Local councillors have, as Michael Frash has put it, is that they're male, pale and stale. They tend to be quite old, they tend to be quite wealthy, because they're the only people that have got the time to do that sort of thing, because actually it's quite a precarious occupation otherwise.
This is why we are so unrepresentative. So if I was speaking at a Fawcett Society inquiry recently into why more women don't become councillors, and I highlighted some of the structural issues we face. So Eric Pickles took away councillors' pensions when he was local government secretary, and he did so on the rationale that we were just like scout leaders. Scout leaders wouldn't get a pension. Why should local councillors? Now, I spend 2.5 days a week is what I'm expected to do as a ward councillor. 5 days a week is what I'm expected to do as a cabinet member. And it's a full-time occupation for me, and then some. So I don't have an opportunity to earn outside of that. I no longer get a pension. It's an issue that it screws everybody over, but it disproportionately affects women who have taken time out to have kids and to care for them, or maybe to take on caring duties for older people. Now, I talked about the fact that when you're a cabinet member, you could lose your income overnight with no warning. And even as a regular councillor, you could lose your income overnight. MPs get 2 or 3 months worth of grace if they lose their seat, so they carry on getting paid for a couple of months, you know, to help you find a new job and to tide you over. Councillors lose all of their income overnight, and you don't know if you're going to keep your seat or not, so you don't know if you need to line up a new job, or, you know, if you lose your seat, you will probably have a few months without an income. Now, you know, imagine taking on that kind of precariousness if you had kids who depended on that income, if you had a mortgage, if, you know, you had dependents. It makes it very difficult. Disproportionately affects younger people and women. And I talked about as well the maternity issue. So recently I inquired as to what my maternity rights might be as a counsellor. I'm not pregnant, by the way. Everybody has asked me this since I inquired. Not pregnant, just eaten too much.
I'll take that off the list.
Yep. So, and I was told, we don't know what the policy is. You'd probably be expected to stand down from your job. And the reason nobody knows what the policy is for cabinet members in local government who get pregnant is it so rarely comes up. You don't get many women of, you know, childbearing age getting to those positions.
Joseph Chamberlain probably was pregnant, but it was covered up.
Yeah. Big scandal in Victorian times back then. But these aren't real jobs, and it, you know, all those structural things add to the male pale and staleness.
Mm.
With no offence to my two outstanding
pale male stale.
Well, I think we're not stale.
Oh, I don't know. I suppose there's barriers for local councillors, there's barriers for MPs as well. I mean, there's a couple of interesting interviews that Owen Jones does in his establishment book. He talks to Robert Haflam, the Tory MP, who said that he spent tens of thousands of pounds trying to become a candidate, almost bankrupted himself. And there's a nice chat with Sadiq Khan, who said that he was lucky he'd run his own business and had time to be the full-time job as running for a candidate. So you've got time to, you know, write mail to the other Labour members in your area. If you're doing shift work, you don't have time to do that kind of thing.
Mm. And I think the other thing is that feeds into the kind of like the issue with MPs is that so many MPs start off as councillors, because if you start off as a councillor, you've demonstrated that you can campaign and you can win seats and you know what you're doing to a certain extent. Now, when you've got those issues affecting councillors and putting off women, people from poorer backgrounds, which almost certainly going to be more disproportionately from ethnic minorities, that's going to feed through into your MP selections as well, which means you end up with a much, again, maler, paler, staler membership of the parliament, you know, people like Sadiq Khan notwithstanding.
And I think also, because it can be quite difficult to get part-time work as well, because I think it's in, especially probably in the public sector, if you're working part-time, you're seen as more expendable. So it's quite difficult to do part-time work and then become part-time counsellor, I think. Because partly the sheer workload and what you're expected to do, but I think also because then you have more demands from your employer. But, you know, if you're a local counsellor, you're trying to talk to various agencies and try and chase stuff up. You're either doing it in your lunch break or you're having to do it in your evenings.
But yeah, from talking to Lib Dem MPs, I know that a number of them only were able to actually be able to run campaigns because they quit their jobs and became consultants. Now, it's really easy to become a consultant if you're in a professional career. Can't do that, as you say, on shift work.
I think also one avenue that a lot of working class people used to use to get into becoming MPs was the trade union movement. So, you know, Alan Johnson, John Prescott are two good examples. And that's kind of disappeared, really, with a hollowing out of the union movement.
Yeah, well, no one's joining unions anymore. I mean, there's an entire separate podcast for us to do to talk about the unions, I think. But
I blame MI5 myself.
I blame the fact they're not relevant to 90% of the people who are working these days.
And the truth will probably be somewhere in the middle. And you end up with, so councillors are very looked down on by national politicians in general.
Mm.
Look at Eric Pickle's comment about being like a scout leader.
Yeah.
My budget is 1.2 billion quid. Name a Labour MP with a penny to their name. You know, we take on big budgets and huge responsibilities. So there's a lot of things that reinforce, though, the idea that councillors are inferior. Quite often, to make ends meet, you'll have councillors who work in the local MP's office, being their caseworker and answering their emails.
Yeah,
and
so the MP is their boss.
But actually in their day job, especially if you're a Labour councillor in Birmingham, you're the one with the most power.
Like, local government is looked down upon because the UK is so centralised and local issues are just seen as being so marginal.
Yeah.
So we've talked about the demonisation of MPs. We've talked mainly about kind of talks on the doorstep. We've talked a little bit about letters. We've talked a little bit about social media abuse. We've talked about that in previous podcasts. And there's almost been a sense that that's part of the game if you're standing as MPs. But in a year that we've seen an MP stabbed on the street on the way to a constituency meeting, you know, we've seen the tragic killing of Joe Cox. I mean, is that a one-off incident, do you think? Is it part of a wider trend?
I don't think we'll know until the trial is concluded whether it was a random nutter or a natural progression of the hatred of MPs and politicians. It certainly affected the way most people I know view their own personal safety at work, because it brought home with a massive slap in the face, actually, what the potential progression is from some of these things.
I was going to say, I do seem to recall one of the Labour MPs, the MP for Yardley, Jess Phillips, kind of talking about how she was having extra security kind of installed at her constituency offices and things like that as a result of Joe Cox's death. And the response on Twitter, again, social media, fucking terrible for politics, was to mock and belittle the fact that she was concerned for her safety.
After her friend
had been murdered. There are certainly things that need to be done in order to try and stop any kind of further progression down this kind of route. I'm not sure we're there yet, and I'm not sure there is actually a kind of a notion about how you can do it. But really, it boils down to one simple fact. People need to remember that politicians are people and they're human beings. They've got emotions. 99% of everybody in the House of Lords, the House of Commons, your local councillors, the people running your council, they're doing it because they genuinely want to make a difference and help people. Yeah, they may argue about how best to do it. Yeah, you may disagree with some of them absolutely vehemently on really big issues and even potentially even minor ones. But at the end of the day, they are all working to try and make your local area better, to make Britain better.
Disagree on how to do it. Yeah. That's the only thing.
And that's something which has been lost quite drastically in the conversations that we have about politicians. The cynicism has taken over. You know, scepticism, I'm all in favour of. But when you assume the worst of them just because they're doing that, that's when we start falling down this kind of a darker path. And I don't think it necessarily ends up with more kind of murders of MPs. I do think it risks more of a kind of a Front National rise up, as is happening in France at the moment, where there is a genuine chance that Marie Le Pen could be elected as President of France.
For me, the two most chilling moments of the US election campaign weren't the building of the wall and you know, some of the horrific things Trump came out with, or his massive misogyny. The most chilling bits for me were his supporters chanting, "Lock her up," "Lock Hillary Clinton up," his political opponent, things that weren't against the law, and him suggesting to his supporters, maybe one of those Second Amendment guys could do something about her. He was literally suggesting somebody assassinate his political opponent in a country where that has happened before and not irregularly.
Yeah.
And to me, that was actually the most chilling thing, because I hate most of what Donald Trump says, but at least there's a democratic process around it. The point where you start suggesting you lock up and murder your political colleagues, no matter how flippantly he was saying it, you've crossed a line. You're starting to, you're feeding that hate and you're planting seeds in people's heads. And those seeds grow.
And it's the problem that we've kind of forgotten the point of representative democracy, and we've kind of forgotten those democratic norms and why it's important. I mean, you can see it now after the referendum. You've got the Daily Mail headline calling judges enemies of the people for interpreting the law.
We seem to have taken the notion that democracy means rule by the people. And yeah, generally speaking, it does. But we've forgotten that there are multiple ways that it works. We aren't Switzerland. We don't have referendums on everything. And what we do is we elect representatives. Now, by all means, make a case for more direct democracy. Make a case for more elected positions. Hell, let's have a debate about elected judges. I think it's a terrible idea. Mm. But let's have that debate. And then we can, put if it's a debate that people want, then we can have a general election and people can vote for the party that wants to do it if they feel that strongly about it. Especially people like judges as well. If you're kind of lambasting them for doing their job, if you're lambasting a politician for doing their job, what are you trying to achieve with it? There's no point to it other than to make you feel
good. Maybe it is a bit of virtue signalling. There's a disconnect between what people see locally and what they assume nationally. There was some polling done on this a while back. I'm talking years and years ago now. Might have been in the middle of the coalition, where they asked, what's your opinion of politicians in general? Unsurprisingly, they're all lying, they're all cheating on their expensive, yada, yada, yada. What's your opinion of your local MP? He's fucking amazing. Or she's fucking amazing. They're all brilliant. Everybody likes, broadly speaking, their local MP. Even if they disagree with their views or they're from a different party, they will go, generally speaking, they're very hardworking. I don't agree with him on a lot, but yes, I like it. I'm satisfied that they're actually doing the job.
And so maybe the solution for all of this is to try and bring decisions down to a local level, which coincidentally is the theme of next week's podcast. We always say this every week, every podcast says this, but if you dislike Donald Trump, then please do subscribe to us on iTunes. Please do leave us a review. That really does help new people discover the show. We'll be back next week. Till then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.